Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you keep an open mind, you'll come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You'll also see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Tonight, my special guest is Dr. Bernie Siegel, who's returning tonight. He prefers to be called Bernie, not Dr. Siegel. He was born in Brooklyn, New York. He attended Colgate University and Cornell University Medical College. He holds membership in two Scholastic Honor Societies, Phi Beta Kappa and Alpha Omega Alpha, and he graduated with honors. His surgical training took place at Yale New Haven Hospital, West Haven Veterans Hospital, and the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. He retired from practice as an assistant clinical professor of surgery at Yale of General and Pediatric Surgery in 1989 to speak to patients and their caregivers. In 1978, he originated Exceptional Cancer Patients, a specific form of individual and group therapy utilizing patients' drawings, dreams, images, and feelings. ECAP is based on Carefrontation, a safe, loving, therapeutic confrontation, which facilitates personal lifestyle changes, personal empowerment, and healing of the individual's life. The physical, spiritual, and psychological benefits which followed led to his desire to make everyone aware of his or her healing potential. He realized exceptional behavior is what we are all capable of. Bernie and his wife and co-worker Bobby live in a suburb of New Haven, Connecticut. They have 5 children and 8 grandchildren. Bernie and Bobby have co-authored their children, books, and articles. Their home, with its many children, pets, and interests, resembled a cross between a family art gallery, museum, zoo, and automobile repair shop. It still resembles these things, although the children are trying to improve its appearance in order to avoid embarrassment. I love that, Bernie. Welcome. How are you tonight?
Thank you. That's very true. I mean, it just as an aside for a minute, I asked a neighbor who was a real estate agent what she thought her house was worth, and she said, if you clean it up, I'll tell you. Because we had old cars and car parts, and, you know, I can't help when I start telling one story, think of another. But it shows you, you talk about spirituality, how you affect the world. We have 5 children. One of them went to automotive and diesel school. He's now, he also is going to law school, he's an FBI agent today, but he was fascinated by fixing and repairing things. So off he went to automotive and diesel school. And in our front yard, we had all these wrecks that he was restoring and then selling. And one day I came out and I had to go give a lecture that evening, and all the cars are gone. You know, 5 kids, my wife, all the cars are gone. The only thing left was this wreck of a Camaro, but thank God it worked, it ran. And so I drove it, you know, half hour or so to my lecture, and I went in and I gave my talk, and I noticed how intense the audience was. I mean, they were so just involved in what I was saying. And at the end, you know, I mentioned something about that, what kind of an audience they had been. And one of them said to me, it's because you are so, oh, what's the word she used? I can't think of it now. But she was referring to how they had expected a doctor to show up in a Cadillac, you know, or a Mercedes. And I had driven up in a wrecked old rusty Camaro. And I started laughing. And she said, "Why are you laughing?" I said, "Because I had no choice. It's not that I'm some, you know, very spiritual individual who isn't concerned about appearances and, you know, things." And then they all understood. But I thought it was so funny. But to think that the car you drive up in affects the audience, you know, what their thoughts are about it. Yeah.
Well, you know, my fella here is saying hello to you. I've got a dog named Shadow, and perhaps that's a good segue to talk about your most recent book. And then I would like to talk about a lot of other things, too. But you certainly are known for finding alternative ways of healing that a lot of doctors don't seem to quite grasp yet. And Murnie's latest book is called Love, Animals, and Miracles. And I'd love to hear a little bit about what inspired the book and what the book is about.
What inspired it is the pattern of my life. I mean, I don't mind being a little out there and just revealing myself and my life. And I may add, the words that that woman used describing me was your humble nature. Well, I've had fascinating experiences. I hope to put it together into an autobiography someday, because I always say my life is more like a movie. I won't get to my childhood and so forth. But a friend asked me over the phone, "Why are you living this life?" when she learned how busy I was, traveling, lecturing, you know. And I said to her, "Oh, my God." And I went into a trance. It was like watching a movie. And I realized I had killed in a past life. Now, I don't mean me, but I mean I had the consciousness of a knight who had killed. And I thought immediately, oh, maybe that's why I'm a surgeon and trying to save lives. But in the killing, it also involved people's pets, you know, who would threaten me. Like, if I came into your house to kill you and your dog came after me, he's going to get his head split open with my sword also. And it really struck me, because I have been rescuing, with the help of our families, animals for decades. And people would say, "Oh, you're on a farm." No, I'm on an acre and a half with a lot of fences. Now, why do I say that? Because we had ducks and geese and goats and every exotic pet, skunk, squirrels that we rescued and veterinarians gave us to bring them back to health. When I say veterinarians gave it to us, I mean, they would call me and say, "Bernie, can you take this, you know, creature?" And I'd say, "Sure, it's okay." So they knew, one, I was a doctor, two, I had all my kids, and I would, you know, restore this creature back to health and then either find a family or keep it. And everybody in the house had a name. And I mean, it didn't matter how many legs you had, but you had a name. And that included snakes and birds and you know, I mentioned in the book, we lived in a zoo. But it taught everybody to respect life. And also the animals became our teachers. When I would do some minor surgery on a pet, and how did I know I was hurting them? Because they weren't anesthetized. They would lick my hand. And that always blew my mind. They didn't turn their heads and bite me. They'd lick my hand to say, "That hurts. Please take it easy." And the other I often mentioned was about forgiveness. One of our dogs, because I didn't keep them apart long enough for them to adjust to each other, I brought a rabbit in that we had trapped in the woods. It must have gotten away from somebody's home. It was a pet type rabbit, not a wild rabbit. And it became a house rabbit. But I kept it separated from the dogs so that they wouldn't hurt it until they got to know it was family. Well, I stepped out of the house for a few minutes and boom, the dog named Furphy grabbed the rabbit. And I just felt awful. And I felt so guilty and terrible. But a couple of weeks later, when I went out to bring the rabbit in before it got dark from our fenced-in yard, I couldn't find her. And I'm walking around calling her name, looking, and then I saw the dog, Furphy, lying on the ground. So I walked over to him And who's hiding behind him, lying up against him, was the rabbit.
Oh, my.
Yeah, that impressed me, that they were friends now. He was helping her to hide because he was very furry under her. And, yeah, there's no problem. He's her buddy, trying to allow her to stay out later at night. Those are the things I felt the animals always were teaching us. And also about the love and affection. And if you need to interrupt and ask a question, go ahead, because all these things have happened to us. We hatched all the eggs in incubators, from turtles to, you know, to geese. And so the first thing all the animals saw when they hatched was our children. And they imprinted upon them. What that means is they see them as if that's my parent. And
right.
So as far as the animals are concerned, you know, their parents were our kids. So when the school year would start, the ducks and geese would go down the driveway with the kids and try to jump on the bus and go with them. And, I mean, the bus drivers had a good sense of humor and nature, so they didn't get upset with me or the animals. And, you know, they would shut the door, not let the pets on, and off the kids would go. And when the bus pulled in the afternoon, there were the ducks and geese waiting. Well, after a while, you get so many, I took a bunch of them down to my parents' home, which was on a lake. And I get a phone call a few days later from my mother. "Bernie, the neighbors are asking me something." "What is it, Mom?" "Every time a school bus pulls up, all the ducks and geese come out of the lake and go up to the street." I laughed, but it showed me their affection, you know, about relationships. They're looking for our kids. And that really impressed me, you know. It was in their hearts. We were family, and they were still looking. And I may add, on the other side, study done in Australia. You have a heart attack. You go home to a house with a dog. The mortality rate 12 months later was 6%. Go home to a house without a dog, and it was 24%. And you'd say, why? The relationships. Your chemistry, and I mean this literally, your body chemistry is altered when you pet a furry creature.
Mm-hmm.
Bonding hormones rise, blood pressure goes down, lots of things. And so having relationships with other living things is so meaningful. And one more, then I'll take a breath. Because one of the stories in the book is by one of our grandchildren, Charlie. He had a turtle, which was fine and eating and happy. And then it began to act depressed, not eating, not moving around. And the vet told him that it's related to his age and the behavior, and to get him some special food, like get him a little fish to drop in the water, something that will excite him and be different. And Charlie felt terrible. I have to give him a fish. Oh, you know, the poor fish. But he went and bought a little fish, and he brought it back home and drops it in the tank. And what happens? The fish and the turtle swam up to each other, bumped noses, and became best of friends. And they're swimming around, eating together, and living together in the same tank. And that's the part.
What a beautiful story.
Yeah, I love, you know, how animals, you know, we all get pictures of tigers with a little pig nursing, you know, from a mother tiger, and the tiger not eating it, you know, that. But it's, again, how the animals accept each other and are complete. That's the word I've learned, that the animals are complete and we are not. We still have a lot to learn, but it makes what we do meaningful. So when we do, I always say, if you don't know what to do, ask yourself WWLD, what would Lassie do? So when somebody acts like Lassie, you really honor them because you know they're making a choice. Whereas if it were Lassie who was giving you a lick, you'd say, you know, what do you expect? And again, I promise I'll stop, but I can't. I was on a massage type table getting some type of therapy the other day, and I had my face, you know, and head on that circular, you know, padded circle where your face is not compressed. It's in the middle of the circle. And I'm lying there, and our dog came over, his name is Rags, and started licking my face. And the therapist said, "I've been doing this for years. I have never seen a dog do that in all the years But it was such a statement of love, you know, that I knew he was concerned about me being on the table. Is everything all right? And he gave me a big kiss right on my nose.
That's beautiful. Well, you know, the one thing that I love about pets is that they seem to be here to teach us lessons in unconditional mm-hmm. love, which we as humans don't always do so well. What are some of the other lessons that animals can teach us that can help us toward healing in our own lives?
I think one that really is significant is living in the moment.
Mm.
I mean, children, I did a lot of children surgery, and I realized that children and animals were teaching me because they were not, well, this is a quote from one of our kids, and it's basically what the animals are telling you. When he was 7 years old, he had a bone tumor, and he had told me he needed an x-ray, which I know now is not a coincidence, that he had an intuitive wisdom, and it showed a bone tumor. Now, my impression of the x-ray and the radiologist was it's a malignant tumor, and I thought to myself, his leg will be off, he may be dead in a year. Oy. I was a mess. This mm-hmm. seven-year-old came to me the morning after I told the family about his x-ray and he'd need surgery, and he came into me while I'm sitting at my desk at home and said, "Dad, can I talk to you for a minute?" I said, "Sure, what is it?" He said, "You're handling this poorly."
Oh.
7 years old, and he gave me a therapeutic lecture. Now, what basically is it, "Dad, we would like to have a nice day, and you're worried about next year, and you want us in our room worrying." And boy, did he teach me a lot in the week before surgery, where I have to say, thank God, he had a rare benign tumor, so he didn't lose his leg or life. But
thank God.
Just that statement, you know, "You're handling this poorly." And that's what the animals teach us. They're trying to have a nice day. They're not thinking about next month. They don't stop in front of the mirror. That's something. I mean, I had a dog, well, that dog, Furphy, I mentioned. He was attacked by other dogs, lost an eye, lost his tail. But he never stepped in front of the mirror and said, "Oh, God, look at me. I can't go out for a walk today. What will people say?" You know? He never asked for a shampoo so he'd look good. And that's the part I think we need to understand and accept, to see yourself as complete and whole. And I've learned, you know, that to me, healing is not about your physical wellness or body. It's about your attitude towards life. So Helen Keller, I love her work, you know, what she teaches me. And I've had lots of people working with me and patients who also taught me. I mean, they could be, you know, blind, lost parts of their bodies, but they're not expecting me to fix and repair that. They're just teaching me about today and life, and let's have a good one. And I may add that when you start doing that, that's the part that got me into this, because I realized when you help people to live, that's what one of my patients said to me, "I need to know how to live between office visits." When you help them live, they didn't die when they were supposed to. And many of them literally had their disease go away, you know, through that love. And one of our animals taught me that. Books have been written since that made it scientific. But he was diagnosed with a malignant melanoma. And on one of his visits to the vet said to me, "Bernie, I've never seen a dog this sick recover. I think we should, you know, put him to sleep while you're here." I said, "Hold it. I'm not going to come home with a dead dog. I got to tell the children ahead of time." So I called the house and I said to the kids, "The vet feels that we ought to put Oscar to sleep." And they said to me, "You don't put your patients to sleep. You don't put Oscar to sleep." I never heard that sentence over the phone. So I brought him home. And what did I do? I did what I was preaching. I loved him. And literally, I would sit on the floor because he couldn't stand up, and I would share breakfast and dinner with him, you know, with a spoon. And I'd love him and pet him every minute I had. And I noticed after 2 weeks, he was not dying anymore. He was walking around the house. And I thought, well, I might as well put him outside with the other dogs. And we did, and treat him normally. He lived for over 3 years with no sign of cancer. And the vet always would see me and say, my God, I've never seen a dog that sick recover. And a book came out a few years ago called The Energy Cure. And I think what cured Oscar was my love and transmitting the universal energy. I always say I was the battery cables and brought that into him. And if anybody has seen a healer, when you feel those hot hands, you know what I'm talking about. Those are the people I really am impressed by and respect. I mean, I've had an injury healed by a healer named Oscar Worrell years ago. Olga Worrell years ago that I knew. And she was giving a lecture at a medical conference. And my wife said, honey, you hurt your leg training, you know, to run. Why don't you ask her to heal you? And I said, because I think it's crazy. She's going to put her hands on me and heal me? Well, my wife asked her to do it. And Olga put her hands on my leg. And within 5 minutes, I was free of pain. And her hands were like two hot irons. And she was tested by many people. See, because if she held a bottle of water and you watered a plant with it, the plant grew faster than if you used water from the sink that she hadn't put her hands on. And it's just fascinating when we do studies that we see, again, how this is real, you know, and people need to keep an open mind. Let's put it that way. Solzhenitsyn, in his book Cancer Ward, uses the term self-induced healing. And he describes it as a rainbow-colored butterfly fluttering out of the book where those words were. See, he doesn't call it a spontaneous remission, which doctors call it. And I thought, wow, this guy intuitively knows because he had cancer. It's self-induced, that you transform your life, find order, the rainbow, and amazing things happen to your body. So, yes, we're all mortal. I mean, I'm not a failure if I die, but it's worth the attempt, see, the potential. Let's see what you're capable of. Stop judging yourself. Stop worrying about failure. Again, the animals don't live that way. You know, I did it wrong. No, you know, they're there to participate and to learn. And I'd say treat yourself again. Train yourself and treat yourself the way you would a pet. One more story from Cat Fancy magazine several years ago, so people understand what I'm saying. You have 9 cats in your house. You and your husband smoke. One cat develops lung cancer and dies. The others are beginning to have breathing problems. What do you do? Now, most people say, oh, you stop smoking. This is in Cat Fancy magazine, a full-page article that ends with, Doug and I now smoke in the yard. We're not killing our cats anymore. We hope you're not killing yours. I couldn't believe the magazine published that with no comment. You know, that they're saying it's okay if you kill yourself, but be good to your cats, because that's what the magazine's about. And then I found Maimonides, 900 years ago, said this, if people took as good care of their animals as they do themselves, no, if they took as good care of themselves as they do their animals, they would suffer fewer illnesses. And
I love that.
To me, is kind of tragic that 900 years later, people are still saying and doing the same thing, you know, hurting themselves and taking better care of their loved ones, which are the animals, not themselves.
What do you think are some of the other most toxic aspects of our emotional lives besides judging ourselves?
Well, the lack of love as a child is the biggest thing. I really feel the biggest public health issue on the planet is parenting. If children grow up feeling loved, they take care of themselves. You know, you're not going to be self-destructive if you feel you're worth something. So in a study of Harvard students, 35 years after graduation, they were asked in college, do your parents love you? No. 98% had suffered a major illness by middle age. Did your parents love you? Yes. 24% had suffered an illness. I call it reparenting patients now. One young lady gave me a wonderful comment. She was suicidal in the office. We were talking. And I said, she said to me, you're my CD. I said, excuse me, I'm a CD? Yes, you're my chosen dad.
Oh.
Okay.
Love it.
And the same is true whether you rescue an animal from the shelter or a person. You reparent them. You let them know they're loved. I've adopted dogs that have been abused by alcoholics. And I've said to them, I love you. You don't have to worry about that here. And they learn that it's true. They don't have to be afraid of me. That if I pick up a broom, it's not to smack them with it. It's to clean the house. And I know, you know, from experiences I've had with those animals. So you grow up with love. What a difference. And if you don't, reparent yourself. Or if you did, become a parent for others. Just let them know you love them. And I add, you don't have to like what they're doing, but love them. An example with patients. There are some people who are self-destructive. I would give them return appointments all the time, which they had never had before. They were always rejected from parents to doctors to school teachers to whatever. But I would always say, I'll see you next week or 2 weeks, whatever. And what I saw was after several months, they realized, I must be worth something. This guy hasn't given up on me. Then I saw them start to change. By that, I mean, you know, taking better care of themselves, not being self-destructive, addicted, and all those things, but to stop and think, hey, I'm worth something. Yeah, I had one young lady call me because she wanted Jack Kevorkian's phone number years ago to commit suicide, you know, for him to help her die.
Mm-hmm.
She's been sexually abused by her father. She has a brain tumor. She wants to be dead. And I said, I love you. Send me some drawings because I interpret them and it helps me know the person. And she's alive today. She's one of my kids now. And I get lots of love from her. And really, it's just such a wonderful experience for both of us to feel loved. You know, at both ends.
Let's talk a little bit about that carefrontation that you utilized with your patients. I'm interested in learning a little bit more about how you interpret drawings and dreams and that sort of thing.
Well, the carefrontation is a word I made up because I wanted people to know I cared about them. You know, they're in a support group or they're my patient, whatever. But I confronted them. They, I mean, it's like if somebody said, I have the worst husband in the world, I'd say, well, I have a mafia friend. Tell me your husband's name and address and we'll get rid of him. I mean, I'm serious when I'd say things like that. I don't mean I'm serious about killing the person, but I would present it to them in that way. So they realize you have a choice. I always remember one woman developed cancer. She was in real estate with her husband. Wonderful at real estate. But she kept saying, all he ever does is tell me I never dress properly. I'm a lousy cook. I don't, you know. And it's not an accident that when you have those emotions, that cancer can become a part of your life because of your body chemistry. And I said to her one day, look, next time your husband comes home, I want you to be naked and no meal ready. And she looked at me. I said, look, he complains you don't know what to wear. Tell him you didn't put anything on because you're always making a mistake. And you don't know how to cook, so you didn't bother to make a meal and fail again. You know, but it's to let the women know you have power. Because I really respect the women. I think the whole world should be run by the women. Their emotions, their feeling, their relationship. See, the men are into, I can't work, what's the point of living? I mean it. Those are fathers and husbands who have said that to me in front of their families. I said, excuse me, it looks like you got a few reasons sitting right here next to you. But no, I can't work. And the women will say, I can't die till you're all married and out of the house. Now, you see, what I worry about that is, and I've seen that happen, the kids all leave home, mama died. And so, again, the women need to care about and for themselves, and the men need to realize that relationships are an important part of our lives. It's not just what you can do, it's being human, not doing human, but being human. And I really feel that you know, we're like God with skin on is a term I like, because that if we're here to do that love, I mean, one of my previous books was called A Book of Miracles. Again, interesting stories, just like this book about animals is. But what I realized as I read the book was that when people chose life, in other words, what was life-enhancing behavior for themselves and others, so it was not about being selfish, but it was life-enhancing behavior for the planet, let's put it that way, that's when the so-called coincidences and miracles happened. You meet the right person, you find, you know, the key to your house. It doesn't matter what it is. But when nothing is going right and you make that choice to choose life, then, boom, amazing things happen and all these stories, you know, get sent to you.
Well, you've mentioned some really powerful words. One of them is power and the other one is choice. And we always have a choice every step of the way. And if we don't exercise that choice in a positive direction, we're going to be met with negative results.
Right. Let me add this word. I like the word potential. For people to realize this is not about failing, but about your potential. So look for life coaches, become what I call a love warrior, and amazing things can happen. You know, we're learning from those who have preceded us and are teaching us. You know, they're common themes. Whether you're reading the Bible or some philosopher or somebody who just wrote a book about their experience with cancer, they're all saying the same thing in different words.
Well, you talked about reparenting, which I think is a very important, I believe it's a very important thing for us to do. What would you suggest to somebody that has no concept of how to do that for themselves because they don't have that self-worth? They don't have. They've never had models to show them unconditional love.
Well, one of the things I started saying to people is to create a sanctuary in your house. Now, what do I mean by that? Get some pictures of yourself and put them up in different places around your house and where you work too. And every time you look at your own picture, honor yourself, love yourself. I mean, the worst answer I had one day when I said to a young woman whose parents committed suicide, told their children to commit suicide, and I said, do you have a picture of yourself as a child so I can show you what you're worth? She said, no, my parents are real estate agents. I can show you the house. That, you know, is tragic. But what did she learn? Because I reparented her and listened to her to let her get the rage out. Her letter that I still have and quote from many years ago was, when I let love into my prison. See, she said, I had no control over the parents who raised me or the circumstances I was exposed to, but when I let love into my prison, it changed every negative item in it, meaning the experience in my life, and changed them into something meaningful. And she has outlived her doctor, because she had an autoimmune disease. I think she had so much anger inside her, she attacked her own body. But she learned to love and to find God, and I mean that in her terms and way. And she became my teacher because she's just, it's like knowing a saint. I mean, she is so beautiful and so at peace with all her difficulties and problems. See, she can learn from her difficulties. I always say, from a comment from a friend of mine, Bernie, do you get upset when you're hungry? No. What do? I get something to eat. She said, then ask yourself, what nourishment do you need? I love that statement. So next time you don't like how you feel, ask yourself, what nourishment do I need? And then the curse becomes a blessing, believe me.
Well, you know, when love seems to be the central theme here, and I do believe that is probably the most powerful healing element there is in the universe. A lot of people are consumed with self-hatred, lack of forgiveness. How would you suggest that people go about the forgiveness process in terms of letting go of resentments and past hurts so that they can come out the other side?
Well, it's a process, first of all, for them not to, in fact, I'll wake up tomorrow and be perfect, but to learn from others who have been through the same thing. As I say, whether it's reading from other philosophers or from books that people write because of what they've been through and then learn something and want to share it. I don't think any of the books have anything new to say, and I don't mean that as criticism. I mean that it's ages old. For the last few thousand years, we've had the wise, you know, people on Earth writing and talking to us. So I think learn from them. As I said, find coaches who have been through something, who are what I call natives because they have experienced the same thing. Like our support groups, you know, we teach each other. There's survivor behavior, so you learn it from them. And the other is to be patient with yourself and learn to say, I'm sorry, too. If, you know, you wound someone, act in a way that you realize was not appropriate, go over to the person and say, I'm sorry. I've learned something from you, and I'm sorry. Because I often say to people, if you want a good doctor, find one who's criticized by patients, nurses, and family. Now, I could say the same thing about a plumber who's criticized by their customers, their family, and their coworkers. Why? Because if they make a mistake, somebody tells them, and they say, oh, God, I'm sorry, I missed that. Thank you. See? And then people aren't afraid to tell you when there's a better way of doing something. But if all you do is say, no, that's not me, that's just, you know, a problem patient, that's a problem customer, that's not my fault, then you stop talking to them because you know they don't care and they're not willing to change. So be willing to change and learn and tell the people around you, I'm happy to hear from you if you feel there's a better way for me to do something. One lady I loved and her husband, he had a pin on the word attitude. And when I met them one night after a lecture, he was talking to me about his cancer and so forth, and then his wife said, you see that pin? I said, yeah. She said, if he doesn't behave the way he should, you know, for his health and benefit, I just walk over, take the pin in my hand, shake it a little, and say, honey, you need to straighten out your attitude. See? And that's such a wonderful way of doing it. She's not criticizing him.
No.
She's trying to help him. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a wonderful story. I love that. One of your other most recent books is A Book of Miracles, which you refer to, subtitled Inspiring True Stories of Healing, Gratitude, and Love. Would you be willing to share a story from that?
Yeah, because something that you mentioned before, I don't think I've ever met or that any medical student has ever been told that Carl Jung, maybe 100 years ago, interpreted a dream and diagnosed a brain tumor. Now, I think doctors ought to be told that. So you go into the office, they say to you, do you have any feelings about what's going on? Have you had a dream about it? And listen to the patient. So I did a drawing for Elizabeth Kubler-Ross many years ago, an outdoor scene, and she had questions for me about my life. I couldn't believe it. To make it simple so people understand, Bernie, what are you covering up? What are you talking about? Because I was hiding all my feelings as a doctor. I was in a lot of pain. I said, why do you ask that? She said, Bernie, this is a white piece of paper. You took a white crayon and made the snow on the mountain. You added a layer. You didn't need to pick up that crayon. What are you covering up? And it went from one thing to another. So I went back to the hospital with crayons and just told people to draw. And you can make physical diagnoses from a drawing. People don't know they're drawing anatomy, but they draw it. I mean, a tree could look like a brain, the branches. Streams can look like bile ducts or blood vessels. And art therapists don't see this because they don't know anatomy. So I was amazed at what I was seeing. But again, the psychiatric journals said they weren't interested in the article because they knew it all. And the medical journals said they weren't interested because it was inappropriate for a medical journal. That's the part of medicine that's such a tragedy, that we separate people. I always say the way that we treat them like a house. You need plumbing, you need your electric fixed, you need your air conditioning, but the human body is an entity. Mind and body are a unit. And so in that book, I may add, when I said coincidences, it's everything from a lady having a dream in which a dark-skinned woman walks in and says, you have a lump in your right breast. This is in her dream. You need to have it checked. At the hospital, they diagnose cancer. Your doctor will be coming in a moment, who will be treating you and you, you know, for your cancer. Who walks into the room? An Indian doctor who was in her dream. The same woman. Boom.
Oh, amazing.
See?
Can
I tell you one other coincidence? This was a couple who was discharged from the armed forces on the West Coast. I'll make it short and quick. They're going to drive across the country and have a vacation. But the car, which is a Pontiac Le Mans, wasn't making the hills. Every time they'd come to a hill, the damn car would slow down. See, they chose life. This is what impressed me. They didn't say, we'll keep driving. If we slow people down, that's their problem. No, they said, look, we're going to drive at night because we don't want to screw up everybody else's day. So we'll stop blocking traffic and we'll drive at night. There goes their vacation. One night, middle of the night, they're driving through Arizona. They come to a hill and a car pulls up behind them, so they pull off the road. The car pulls off ahead of them and they were getting a little nervous, you know, in the middle of nowhere. But the guy who walks over says, I am the original designer of the Pontiac Le Mans. I know what's wrong with your car. And it was a hose through which excess fuel is suction, but it was sucking too much. He fixes it in 5 minutes by plugging that tube, and they have a wonderful ride home across the country. Now, how does that happen in the middle of the night in Arizona?
So that's pretty amazing.
I say, yeah. Choose life and good things happen.
I love the story about the Indian doctor. It reminds me of a healer that I have on my show. Her name is Ada Marie. And she had a doctor come into her room. She was diagnosed with lung cancer. And the doctor came into her room and said, why are you so mad at your mother? I want you to list three positive things about her. And the doctor went away, and she thought about it, and she came up with three things. And the next day, the other doctors that had been treating her came into the room, and she asked about this one doctor, and she was told there's no such doctor. But they examined her, and all of her symptoms of cancer had disappeared. So it's amazing.
Yeah, that, no coincidence, yeah.
No
See,
coincidence.
I hear so many of these stories because of the people I work with, and they know I'm not going to judge them. Mm. I mean, I had a patient who was a mystic. She came into the office one day in one of her visits and said, Bernie, now that I know you're not a normal doctor, I have things to tell you. And she gave me messages from dead patients, even from my dead parents, even from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, all of whom were dead. And I knew what she was saying was exactly accurate because she knew none of them, but knew their names, what the way they spoke, you know, the terminology they used. And she was just giving me reports. And so literally now, if people say they've had a loved one die, I say, well, if you like to communicate with them, I'll have you call Monica and she'll, you know, bring you a message. And, you know, I get books now, too, with the same thing when people lose their loved ones and then they get messages from them. And I could tell you a bunch of those stories, especially from parents where their children or some symbol, something that children loved, like a bird flying into a room or a butterfly from South America appearing in Connecticut. I mean, it's just, yeah, I had, with my wife, a butterfly on the island of Kauai stay with us for a day and a half. We rescued it out of a store because it was confused by the lights. But one of my patients had died there a year before. That butterfly went back to our hotel, up to our room. When my wife tried to shake it off so we could go to sleep, it came back in off the porch on her other shoulder and flew over the workshop I did outdoors from 9 in the morning till 5 at night. Now, I mean, that is not a coincidence. I wrote a story about it on my website called You Can't Sleep with a Butterfly. Because I said that to my wife when it was bedtime. I said, you can't sleep with a butterfly. You got to, you know, brush it off, get rid of it. We couldn't. And at that point, I said, it's got to be her spirit, my patient's spirit. So I just started talking to Butterfly like it was another person. And believe me, we can communicate through consciousness. Because in the book about animals, yeah, there are stories, including one by my friend Amelia Kincaid, who is an animal intuitive. And she has told me where to find lost pets. I'm in Connecticut. She was in California and Africa twice when I asked her for help. And she told me exactly where the animals are. Her words were, Bernie, the cat's alive. I can see through its eyes. And boy. So I went from being, again, a non-believer, thinking, if you talk to cats, lady, you're a little bit crazy. To writing a foreword for her book, because you could not deny the incredible accuracy of her description of the house and other pets and everything else. And next morning I went out and picked up the cat where it was hiding.
That's a beautiful story too. You have many wonderful stories, and you know, you're so easy to interview because you answer my questions before I ask them.
Yeah. Well, one of my lines for the end of the program is when you say to me, Bernie, we're running out of time. My comment to everyone is, we're all going to run out of time. So enjoy.
Yeah, right. Well, the question is what to do to make the most of our time. Okay. And I love the story about your son who taught you about living in the present, because so many of us are so focused on the future or caught up with past concerns that we don't really truly appreciate life.
Yeah. And yeah, you know, I mean, something, let me say on a practical level, because I thought of this earlier when you asked me a question, that what one exercise is to say various mantras. Therapists teach them, others. I mean, you can say some prayers. You can say, thank you for everything. I have no complaint whatsoever. Lao Tzu said, I'm content with what I have. I rejoice in the way things are. Nothing is lacking. The whole world belongs to me. It does help you to say those things. And another that I found very helpful is, what are you grateful for? And I like to make it tough, that you start on the first day of the month with three things that begin with the letter A that you're grateful for. The next month, you can't use the same ones you used the month before. And what you find is, after a few months, it gets damn hard to think of, what am I grateful for that begins with the letter A? But the reason I began to love that, because I heard some therapists suggest it, was I was laughing one morning thinking, you're having trouble now finding something you're grateful for. See, whereas a few months ago, what would you be doing in the morning when you walk in the dogs? What's wrong? What do I have to do today? What's going on? But when you switch into that other place, what am I grateful for? It begins with the letter A. Yeah. Oh, apples. No, I said apples. you know? And I just enjoyed that so much that I'm struggling now with gratitude. So use that, as I say, and always ask, what am I to learn from this experience? See, one of our sons, I learned from our kids a lot too. Sitting in a group of people, I said to them, look, you got 15 minutes to live. What would you do? I heard many answers. One guy said, I'd play golf. You know, most people, I was talking to some tonight, were saying, oh, you know, I'd think about who I love and let them know. And I got to our son who was sitting there, and he said, yeah, I'd buy a quart of chocolate ice cream and eat it. I said, I don't worry about you, see? The guy who said the golf said, wait a minute, why are you being tough on me? What if golf is my chocolate ice cream? And that, I loved it when he and my son, you know, put that together. So I'd say to people, find your chocolate ice cream and go and live it. I mean, literally, Monday morning, we have more heart attacks, strokes, suicides, and illnesses. See? But if Monday was, if you loved your work and you loved helping people, see your work, whatever it is, as helping people, then you have a different feeling, and your body doesn't find Monday as a problem, because now it's an opportunity to go out and bring something to the world and offer something to the world. And that's all the difference in the world. And to not be selfish, but again, to try to help the world.
Beautifully put. It reminds me of Joseph Campbell, who used to talk mm-hmm. about following your bliss. And I'm a firm believer that when we follow our life's passion, then we always find things to be grateful for. And it seems to me that that attitude of gratitude, along with an attitude of love, are two of the most important things that we can focus on in this life.
Absolutely. He's been one of my teachers. You know, he says in his way all the things that I'm saying. One of the other themes that I found universal was the still pond, because he shares that, where the ugly duckling sees he's a swan on a still pond. See, and he doesn't walk away from home where he's been thrown out, resenting and hating his mother. Because I have people's letters that say, my mother's words were eating away at me and maybe gave me cancer. But the ugly duckling went off into his own life and could see. Ed Campbell used a different example. He said a tiger dies giving birth, and she was chasing some goats. But the goats come back, look at this little baby tiger, and say, hey, we might as well raise it. Don't let the baby die. So they raise the tiger, and he grows up, and he thinks he's a goat. And Campbell says, then another tiger comes along one day and says, hey, stupid, come here. You're not a goat, you're a tiger. And Campbell has a sense of humor, because the new tiger says, here's a piece of meat. And the other one says, no, I'm a vegetarian. But he says, come with me. And he takes him to the still pond and says, look, you're a tiger, you're not a goat. But the still pond to me represents your mind. That if it's full of resentment and bitterness and what a terrible world and look what people have done and I don't have anything, yeah, you're never going to have that still pond and see your beauty and the truth. But when you can quiet your mind, then, yeah. And just as you said, when people haven't been parented, yeah, quiet your mind. Look in that mirror. Look at the photograph of yourself. Stop saying, I'm, you know, a mess and ugly. I mean, I was born an ugly duckling due to birth trauma. I'm not going to go into details, but I had a sick mother who shouldn't have become pregnant, couldn't survive a cesarean section. It's a horrendous story. When I said, learned this as I grew up, because there's no photographic proof of this. They never took pictures of this ugly duckling. There are pictures of covered carriages. But anyway, I said to my mother, when she told me the truth, why am I not a drug addict or an alcoholic then? Because nobody's touching me. They're hiding me in a carriage. She said, oh, my mother took you. See, good old grandma. She took me, poured oil. These are my mother's words. She poured oil all over your body and pushed everything back where it belonged several times a day.
Wow.
Imagine being that kid. I thought, oh, then I was the most loved kid on the freaking planet. I'm getting loved five times a day, you know, by someone. But that, yeah, my grandmother saved my life. And again, the memories are stored in us. 50 years later, I go for a massage with my wife. I like male massages that coarse hands and strength. But he was very busy. He said, look, I can do your wife, but I don't have time for you. My wife's a therapist. Could she do yours? I said, fine, there's no problem. I open my eyes into the massage, and there are six people in the room staring at me. I said, what the hell's going on? I'm here for a massage. What are you all doing here? This is a quote from the therapist. We thought you had a heart attack or a stroke. You were not here. You were gone. We could not communicate with you. I said, I know. I had a shaved head at that time, like the infant. And a woman's hands with oil on my head put me back to being an infant. I know. You know what I mean? I felt that.
Oh, the body remembers.
Yeah. And so when I opened my eyes, I was feeling absolutely incredible. And they were scared to death that something had happened to me because I wasn't there anymore. Yeah, I said, I became an infant. I couldn't communicate with you. But we know this now from organ transplants, that those things very much are true. It's amazing the stories people wake up with when they have major organ transplants and know the name of the person. And as one woman said, after the heart and lung transplant, they came in and said to her, "Would you like a drink?" She said, "Yeah, I'd like a beer." She said, "Wait a minute, I've never had a beer in my life." But whose heart and lungs are in her? A teenager who had died in a motorcycle accident with, and he loved beer and chicken McNuggets, which she was eating like crazy also after leaving the hospital. And she even went for a motorcycle ride, which she'd never done in her life, and finally tracked down his parents because he appeared to her in a dream and told her his name. And she, through the obituaries, found his family and met with them. That's why I say these things are not coincidences, why so many books get written about them. You know, whether it's your husband comes back or your child returns or you have these incredible memories after an organ transplant, that's, it's the consciousness that is universal and doesn't die after the body does. So that's why I say that we are impregnated with the consciousness when we're born of those who have preceded us. And that can affect the choices we make, the kinds of life that we live and everything else.
Absolutely. No question about it. Well, we're running out of time. I wonder if, just one last question, if a patient comes to you and says that they're dying, what would you say to that person?
Well, I have to ask in this sense, if they're ready to die. See, like my father said to my mother, "I need to get out of here." I explained to her he was ready to go. He did not enjoy his body anymore. So we said to him, "When do you want to die? We'll all get together and we'll be at your side." And he died laughing with my mother telling stories about their life and early dates. It was an incredible experience, see? So that's one question. If you're ready to die, let's turn off the switch. So you're not a failure. You know what I mean? You don't have to die at night in the middle of the night when the doctor isn't there and your family isn't there to make you feel guilty. Let everybody know and do that. On the other hand, if they said, "No, I don't want to die," then it's okay. Let's look at your life. What are you experiencing? What's going on? What can we eliminate that's killing you? See, often I'll say to people, "What are you experiencing with your illness or problem?" And words come out of them. Like one woman, failure. How does that fit your life? "Well, my body failed. I have cancer." That's not my question. How does failure fit your life? "Oh, my parents committed suicide when I was a child. That must have been a failure as a child." Now, that was a woman who had no relationships. Why not? "Well, I'll get hurt again, like what my parents did to me." So that statement of mine in the office changed her life. And she went out and started a new life. So she's not going to die on schedule, if you know what I mean.
I do.
And I know even people who have said, "I'm going to go to Colorado. I want to die in the mountains. It's beautiful." And another was a millionaire friend who said, "I'm going to go buy a house in Miami on the ocean to meditate, you know, with your CDs and watch the water." Now, the guy in Colorado, I called up because I hadn't been invited to the funeral, and he answered the phone. This is a year later. I was really, well, I won't use a negative word, but I was very annoyed with the family for ignoring my desire to come to his funeral. And he answered the phone and said, "It was so beautiful here, I forgot to die." And then the millionaire canceled the dress code at work. "I can't wear a tie anymore because of him." He said, "I'm going to be dead in 2 months. What the hell's the point of wearing a tie and a jacket?" He went to his business, told everybody there, "Wear whatever you want. I don't care what you show up in." He lived for over 5.5 years. And when he introduced me a few times down in Florida when I was lecturing, he would always come casually dressed. And that's when I learned his story. I said, "How come you don't have a jacket on and a tie?" And he said, "Hey, if I'm going to die in 2 months, you know, who the hell's the point of putting on a tie?" And so
there you go.
I cannot put it on. I mean, my closet may have a lot of them, but I cannot put it on because I don't need to impress people. I'm just going to live my life, be who I am.
It's the best thing to be for any of us. Well,
yeah,
thank you so much.
And as I say, if you need a role model, just ask yourself, what would Lassie do? And then go and do it.
Sounds good. Well, that's a good note to end on, Bernie. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for being such a good listener.
My pleasure. So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who can and will have a spiritual experience if we let it be. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.